one talk that he gave in Portsmouth, the room filled so much with people that the floor gave way and 60 people fell into the cellar beneath.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. John Sadiq talks with Yvonne Singh about her new book, Ink.
Hello there, welcome to Ilkley Literature Festival. I'm John Sadiq, and it's my great pleasure to introduce you to Yvonne Singh. We're going to sort of converse about her journey and about this wonderful book, of course, and some of the characters that appear in it. So, Yvonne, I wanted to ask you if you would begin, and we'll come to the book in a bit. Maybe share with us a little bit about your kind of initial journey as a writer. Where did the writing urge come from for you? And when did you notice it?
So I've been a journalist for an incredibly long time. And, you know, I was always interested in people and interested in stories. And first of all, yeah, I just want to thank you all for coming out on like a really horrible day, you know. But yes, I've always been interested in people and interested in stories and writing. My father was a postman and he used to bring back the Daily Mirror and lots of papers from the stands, you know, where he'd get them free after his night shift. And I'd read John Pilger, I'd read Paul Routledge, people like that, and I was fascinated by them and I always wanted to be a journalist. When I said to my careers teacher at school I wanted to be a journalist, she said, well, you'd be better off being like a nurse, like your mum. So I did do a bit of voluntary work and nursing, but I kept writing and I kept writing and I wrote for music magazines and things like that. So I've always been interested in writing and writing stories about people. And I suppose that grew because journalism is a certain type of writing, and that grew into sort of my interest in narrative non-fiction, which is sort of like marrying the worlds of fiction and non-fiction writing. So using the tools of fiction to tell non-fiction stories, to make them as interesting as possible. And the really great practitioners of that are people like David Gran, you know, who write for The New Yorker. And so that's my aspiration anyway.
Wonderful. And the two books that we haven't seen yet, are they this?
So the two books that you haven't seen. So the first book I wrote for my MA in creative writing. So I was really, really lucky. So about 12 years ago, I was taught by Tessa Hadley. I was taught by Sam Harvey, who won the Booker at Bath Spa University. So I had some wonderful tutors and I wrote my first fiction novel. So I went from journalism to writing fiction. But I did think as a journalist that you do need to learn the craft. You really do. You can't just go from writing journalism, you know, where you're working with facts to writing fiction, because you suddenly have to make quotes up. It's going somewhere different with it. And you have to learn the essence of craft. And I was lucky to get good teaching and good practitioners. So my first novel, I wrote it for my MA. And again, I was lucky enough to win the second prize. And yes, I Leeds competition with that. It didn't get published. And then I wrote a collection of short stories about the newspaper industry, because some of you may or may not realise, but I went into the newspaper industry just at the end of print. So things were dying. And we were all thinking, you know, we'd have these big meetings. And what are we going to do? The internet's coming. And that collection was focused, the collection of short stories of a newspaper industry on the brink, digital was coming and what was going to happen. And I thought it was funny and interesting, but it didn't get published either.
Well, we identified a little bit of the intro of Yvonne's book that I thought might actually kind of serve as a way into it and to kind of entice you to pick up a copy when you go out. Even though it's not out to the 16th of October, there are some copies out there. So would you read a little bit from the intro for us?
Of course, John. Newspapers are often cited as the first rough draft of history, But what does it mean when your history is not deemed worthy of preservation? In his book, Black Ghost of Empire, The Long Death of Slavery and the Failure of Emancipation, Chris Manjapara refers to the Pan-Africanist philosopher W.E.B. Du Bois, who stated that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the colour line. To Du Bois' articulation of an all-pervasive intergenerational harm wrought by racial discrimination, Manjapara adds that the problem of the 21st century is that of the ghost line. He elucidates that because of slavery and colonialism, certain human groups have been made into phantoms in other people's eyes. Quoting from Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, he states, "They are told that their history is not substantive to remember and to call human history." When your history is condemned to the spectral realm, when many of the UK's established institutions, libraries, museums, and archives do not deem it worthy of space or commemoration, its ephemeral nature means it can be all too easily forgotten. It can also, in the current political climate, where the past is weaponized for political gain, be deemed like the phantasmagorical inhabitants of our imagination, the Jumbies, the Wraiths, and the shapeshifters, unbelievable. It pained me to read recently that the 1976 BBC programme, where the sociologist Stuart Hall interviewed the foremost black intellectual, C.L.R. James, on his 75th birthday in May of that year, was destroyed, wiped before transmission, because the BBC Director General at that time, Aubrey Singer, stated in an internal memo, "Sorry, but I have no interest in a 45-degree conversation with C.L.R. James. A history unrecorded because of one man's choice." Or that the director Steve McQueen, on the promotional junket for his 2024 film Blitz, has to constantly explain that 1940s London was a cosmopolitan and diverse place with a large Chinese community. There were a lot of black people, Asian people. The keys, in particular, the photographs of the children's trips to Epsom, funded by Harold Moody, immortalizes in celluloid a diverse, multicultural 1930s London. Likewise, Ali's Herculean attempts in the review to continually highlight the contribution of the colonies to the First World War effort had a purpose. He knew back then that this story would be conveniently erased from collective memory. More than a century later, he has been proved right, as few British people are aware of the contribution of colonial troops to both world wars, such as the 1.4 million Indian soldiers who served alongside British troops in the First World War, or that the country donated a significant amount to Britain's war chest, 146.2 million, approximately 14 billion in today's money.
See, the problem of erasure is what struck me so movingly about your book. And I'm just so grateful for it, I have to say. I'm just so grateful for this. And there's been a few other books recently, like Lanre Bakari's We Were There, and so on. And I've started to see that emerging, that we're getting what I call, I'm building this little shelf at home called Lost History Books. And that these books need to be, you know, in schools. And the over the last few days while I've been reading your book, you know, the tender spot in my heart at being 61 years old, not knowing that these people even existed, how they would have helped my journey, having been able to read them. This is just me as a reader. That's all I am, really, at the end of the day, as a reader, rather, you know, even more than an author. And how impoverished we are as a country because of not knowing these. How did you deal with going into archive after archive and you know, the state in which these things were kept, if they were kept at all? How did you work with that?
It was really, really hard. I mean, I say in the introduction that there was a black librarian at the British Library, and he sort of apologised when he handed me the copy of the African and Orient Review. He was just like, I'm sorry, this is in such a bad state. They didn't really care about our history. They didn't really preserve it as such. And it is sort of heartbreaking because, you know, these things are falling apart. And they, you know, Douste Mohammed Ali, who was the editor of the African Times and Orient Review, he's quite a character if you read the book, but at 40, he sort of had this sea change and he did this sort of very worthy project. And he wanted to highlight what it was like for life in people in Britain's colonies. The fact that it hasn't been preserved is so sad. You now have the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., so you have to go to the U.S. for a lot of these things. And I think their black history is, you know, they preserve it better over there. I don't know what the reasons are for that, but they do. So the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. does have all the copies of Ali's review. But what is heartbreaking is that Claudia Jones, we're talking quite recent history, we're talking 1958 that the West Indian Gazette came out. You know, there's only 4 complete runs in this country. And 2 of those are duplicates on microfilm, and they're all tattered, the pages are all tattered. If you read Claudia Jones' writing, there's a book of essays which escapes me at the moment, but it's in the back, in the notes of the book. She was a brilliant woman. She was very, very sharp. And the fact that her newspaper has not been preserved in its entirety is so sad, you know, because these stories need telling. And they speak of an age, they speak of, you know, what was going on at that time, you know, they're portals of history. So they, you know, at that time, you've got the anti-colonial movement in full swing, you've got what was going on in South Africa, you know, Trinidad was refusing to unload the ships from South Africa, you know, all of these things were happening. And that history, if it's not preserved, it's not told. And I think that's what's sad when you go through these things.
Would you like to sort of give us a little insight into kind of 2 or 3 of these people, or
yeah,
tell us a story about each one?
So I suppose I'll start with, I mean, I suppose he's the most fascinating is Samuel Jules Celestine Edwards. And if you see the cover of the book, you know, he's there with a top hat. He was always never without his top hat and coat and with a flower in his boutonniere. And, you know, he was a great guy. He's born in Dominica. He ran away. So in Dominica, there were the sailors at the port near where he lived. And these were Lascar sailors from Malaysia and India. And he'd go as a schoolboy and listen to their stories. And he was just fascinated by the world beyond the island of Dominica. So he ran away when he was very, very young.
He was 11, wasn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, his mum's, you know, at the port going, come back. And that was it. He was gone. He just had this amazing life, you know. And then he ended up in England. And a lot of sailors were, you know, they were into drink at the time. And he'd taken... You know, he'd taken a vow of Christianity and temperance, and he started to give these temperance addresses in Edinburgh. And because he hadn't had any schooling, or his schooling had been cut short, he felt a bit insecure about that. So he used to buy books, you know, and read, and constantly read all of the time. And he was giving these addresses, and he found that he was quite talented at making speeches. So he got taken on by the Primitive Methodists, and they would put him in halls and he'd speak to people. And, you know, the chapter opens with him getting quite a weird reception at one of those speeches that he made in the East End of London.
But what was in that book here?
Huh?
What was in that? What was thrown at him?
So, he was basically, he was stood on the stage and, you know, he didn't know what these men in the front were just chewing rapidly, and he didn't know what they were chewing, and they were actually chewing, you know, tobacco, and they just lobbed it at him. They spat at him. So they spat at him so much that he was forced back he wrote in his diary, he was forced back on the stage. And then his mates, his fellow Primitive Methodists, came out and tried to calm them down. And it just got worse and worse. So this is a really deprived part of the East End. And, you know, it's like some, the women started making lascivious dances, he wrote. And then, yeah, he just got on the organ and he started playing. They just stopped what they were doing and they quietened down. And he realised, because back in that day, you know, in the Victorian times, entertainment was in the parks, you know, that's where you got your news, you got people standing up and making speeches. So he realised he had a real talent for making speeches and telling the news of the day. So he'd share the stage, with luminaries like Annie Besant and people like that in the East End of London. And he'd give these speeches, you know, and everybody absolutely loved him. And they loved him so much, they gave him a pulpit. One talk that he gave in Portsmouth, and it's the room filled so much with people that the floor gave way and 60 people fell into the cellar beneath. And because he was a doctor, he ended up treating, you know, these broken ankles and injuries, you know. But yeah, that gives you some idea of his popularity, so.
Oh my gosh. Could we look at one of our wonderful women?
Yes, yeah.
That I'd really love,
Una Marson.
Una Marson, I was fascinated by her.
Yeah, yeah, her story is really moving and it kind of moves you to tears because she came over to England and she was quite ruthless actually. She really wanted to publish her poetry. She came over to England for a reason to publish her poetry. And she got in touch with Dr. Harold Moody. So some of you might be aware of his story. He lived in London and he was basically, he'd arrived in London, he was a doctor of Edwardian sensibility. So a lot of us that have West Indian heritage, people don't realise, but you know, my dad grew up and when he was at school in Guyana, you take an oath to the Queen, you get an English education. It's an English curriculum. You follow an English school curriculum. So when you come over to England, you think it's the mother country. So he was basically, Harold Moody was hit by the fact that it wasn't the mother country, that he couldn't get any accommodation. He arrived in 1912. So his mission was to make things easier for other Jamaicans and other people who came over from the West Indies when they came over to England. A lot of people were coming over to study, you know, people were working as nurses then. And this was before Windrush. So he'd open his home. So Una Marson met him and she stayed with him in London. But even though she was quite tough and resilient as a journalist, she set up a female magazine in Jamaica. She found London quite hard, like the racism that she faced. And she wrote, you know, quite visceral poetry about how she was, you know, these kids racially slurred her in the street. Harold Moody was always thinking of schemes to make the British government aware of colonials, so he and the issues that they faced in London. So he thought, I will produce this newspaper called The Keys. And Marson, because she had experience in newspapers in Jamaica, he took her on board as a secretary. And eventually, within about an issue, she became the editor. And she loved it, and she was working with him. And the London community, 1930s Black Britain was really burgeoning. There were places, there were people who were hanging out. You had a big African community, a big student community. So she was reporting on all that. But then you were getting, the build-up was happening of fascism in Europe. And so that was all happening. So in the background noise, the soundtrack to all that was the invasion of Abyssinia. Una didn't really know about Africa, because she was Jamaican. But it became her mission to know about Abyssinia and what was going on. She got in touch with the ambassador, who was a strange character. He's called Charles, and he rattled around in this big mansion in Kensington. He was on his own, and his country was being invaded, and he needed a secretary to help him. So she went to work for him, And she literally found all this correspondence was coming through her. And it became her mission, almost, to save the Abyssinian people. And when it didn't work out, that crushed her. It completely crushed her. And she went back to Jamaica. And it was almost, you know, the story's in the book, and I can't go into it in too much detail, but it was something that she realised, the chicanery of global politicians, that she could not help what was happening to this small country. That I found a fascinating story. And then when she was back in Jamaica, she did a lot of work on the strikes and working people. And then she came back again to London. And this time it was coming up to the Second World War. And during the Second World War, she was working with George Orwell and people like that. And, you know, again, telling the stories of colonial troops that were helping out in London and raising awareness of that. But she found working for the BBC was quite hard because she was almost having to be Janus face, you know, in an organisation where there was substantial racism directed towards her. And again, that crushed her. So it's a really sad story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Really
Absolutely.
Sad story.
Yeah. And what just a little diversion. One thing I found really interesting about each of our seven people is that that poetry's in the background of a lot of their lives, isn't it? And they're all writing poetry and plays and so on. So they're kind of like, you know, as a container for their experience outside of the work that they're doing and their travels that they're doing. There's these kind of dreams of being a poet, but also the receptivity of literature as being one of the only places they can actually put their experience. And I found that quite a moving thing.
Yeah, so you've got Claude McKay, and one of the most famous poems that he wrote was If We Must Die, which was written in the Red Summer in America. And that was 1919. And it's a really, really powerful poem because, you know, there was massive race riots after demobilization. A lot of black troops came back to the United States. And they're like, we're fighting for this country. Can we have equal rights? And they were up against it. There were massive riots. I think it was something like 29 cities just erupted in flames. He was working on the railroad. So they just, if you were on the railroad, which was a majority black profession, you would just sit there in the dining car in your waiter's uniform, all white waiter's uniform, just sat there rigid while it came into the stop, thinking, what's going to happen? And am I going to get lynched? Is somebody going to get on the car? That's how terrified he was. So that's how he wrote If We Must Die. And that was published by Max Eastman's The Liberator, which was a left-wing magazine in New York. And then it was taken on by Sylvia Pankhurst. Sylvia Pankhurst published it in her work as Dreadnought. And that led to a lifelong collaboration between the two of them. So poetry punctuates his career. And also that was the case with Claudia Jones as well, who's an incredible poet, you know, and wrote a lot of her poetry in when she was incarcerated in America during the McCarthy years.
I want to kind of highlight my own little organisation, the Royal Literary Fund and Writers Mosaic, for a moment.
Oh, yeah.
Because we, as the Royal Literary Fund, realised about 5 or 6 years ago that without actually creating a true space for the global, that we wouldn't survive. And so we created Writers Mosaic as a sort of protected space in which, and this is going to lead to a tiny little question, in which we've tried to make a space which is kind of like an online magazine, but we've started to move into print now, where a writer of colour, or a writer of the global majority, as we tend to use that term these days, is actually free to write what they want. Because one thing we don't realise is that if you are a writer of colour, the greatest coloniser is the one that you've internalised. And then, even if you're not just having to fight against that, even if you are quite free in your thought and so on, or you're able to heal and free yourself, then there's no one to publish you, you know, unless you bleed for them in the way that they tell you to, grieve for them in the way that they tell you to, exoticize yourself How free do you feel to write what you want?
That's an interesting one. I have written a lot about climate change recently and green issues. I'm from a small town in Kent, and you know, we have a small refugee centre in our town. So I recently wrote something about that. Do you think you somehow still get channeled off into sort of writing about race and race issues? You know, I do like writing about comedy. I have got a very dark sense of humour. I particularly like Korean dramas. And yeah, all of that stuff. Alice in Borderland, if anyone's watching that at the moment, cracking. I do like writing about that stuff, but whether I would get published is another thing entirely, right? But then you think Octavia Butler, people like that, wrote brilliant sci-fi. So it's possible. Just keep going, I think.
You've got to keep going. You've got to do the work, yeah. Toni Morrison famously says that racism is the distraction from the work, isn't it? So you've got to find a way to do the work somehow. So we need to create systems and support in which that work can be done, because then the world is changed, isn't it, by the creation of the work rather than fighting against the windmills, I suppose, of these, you know, sometimes phantoms that could actually kill you as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, Yvonne Singh.
John Sadiq was in conversation with Yvonne Singh. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.